Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Titley, and welcome to the FinTech Australia podcast. The FinTech Australia podcast takes listeners on a deep dive across the fintech industry in Australia, focusing on the challenges, opportunities, and big stories our community faces. Let's get to today's episode. Hi, it's Chris Titley here, and today on the FinTech Australia podcast, we're talking to three amazing fintechs out of Scotland. As we all know, fintech has emerged as a transformative force in the financial sector, offering innovative solutions that not only enhance financial services, but also broader societal issues, including environmental sustainability, customer vulnerability, and overall financial well-being. Those objectives are heavily featured in the Research and Innovation Roadmap, published by FinTech Scotland 2 years ago. In Scotland, the majority of fintechs that are aligned to those objectives are seen as fintech for good. Today, we'll explore what we mean by fintech for good by looking at three Scottish fintech examples that are changing paradigms across a wide range of topics. We'll also take some time to consider how those organisations are driving positive change. This episode is recorded in collaboration with FinTech Scotland, the fintech cluster management organisation, and their marketing director, Mikhail Paris. Mikhail is joined by Ren Hui, founder and CEO at Lightning Reach, Robin Peters, co-founder and CEO at Snug, and Sheila Hogan, founder and CEO at Biscuit Tin. Mikhail, over to you.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be collaborating with our peers in Australia, and I'm delighted to be joined by some of the most inspiring fintechs in Scotland, all working towards fintech for good. So I'd like to ask my guests just now maybe to start by explaining how their respective companies are revolutionizing the financial sector for the average consumer, really. I'm not sure who wants to start. Ren, maybe?
Yeah, sure. Hi, I'm Ren from Lightning Reach. We have a financial support portal that makes it quick and easy for individuals to find and apply for financial support. So basically being able to connect to things like charitable grants, help from their councils or government, or additional support with their bills that companies can provide. What we're changing is that very fragmented process of finding support. At the moment, there are about £19 billion in benefits unclaimed, and that's sort of outside of things like grants and other support that people might get, and very low awareness of what's out available, as well as a very convoluted journey for consumers to be able to access the support that's available. So what we're doing is making it really simple for individuals to understand what they could be eligible for and go on to apply for it by partnering directly with a number of different organizations, and also helping these organizations to streamline their application process and make it more efficient to support people in need.
That's fantastic, especially with those difficult economic conditions at the minute. You'd like people to access all the money they can as and when, really. So that's a fantastic idea. Sheila, do you want to go next?
Yeah, can do. Thank you, Mikhail. Sheila from Biscuit Tin. And our mission is to make death a little easier to deal with by actually providing a suite of digital products and services that help people to organise the practical bits of the life, but also protect the precious moments for the future. Bereavement is, it's going to happen to everyone. We're all going to die, but unfortunately, we put our head in the sand. And Biscuit Tin was born on the back of my personal experience of having to close down the lives of my parents and finding out that that process is completely broken and very traumatic. It took me 2 years to close down my dad's life. I didn't know what he wanted. And after those 2 years, I had a bit of an epiphany and kind of thought, oh my goodness, my life is so much more complex than my dad's ever was. And if I were to die now, I would be leaving such a mess for my family to deal with businesses they were involved in, pension pots dotted all over the place. I didn't even know where they were. And nobody talking about what I actually wanted, in terms of to happen when I died. And we've all got so much more digital stuff these days. So it's estimated that each of us have at least 130 online accounts. just now. Right. And I'm sure all of us have seen work anniversaries come up for people that have died on LinkedIn, which is very uncomfortable. But bottom line is nobody knows that this stuff's there or what to do with it. So it's not just the that kind of thing. But so BiscuitTin is effectively a digital secure vault that holds all your life information, both, you know, all your account information, from financial stuff, you know, down to social media stuff. And it's all in one place that's then released when you die to the people that need it. And yeah, so we're just trying to make that whole process a lot easier for the people that are bereaved. It's estimated that, you know, I mean, just in the UK alone, there are 620,000 deaths per annum. And it's estimated that 5 people are bereaved on the back of every death. Which means that you know, every year in the UK alone, there are 3 million people that are bereaved, and a bereaved person is effectively classed as a vulnerable person. It's very traumatic, obviously, when you lose someone close. And globally, that figure moves up to 300 million. So 300 million bereaved across the world every year, equivalent to the size of the US. So it's big scale stuff, and it's everybody's business, and we all need to make it better. And we've all got, and in terms of financial services, you know, there is a consumer duty, really, to help improve this for everyone. So that's where we're at. Yeah, thanks, Mikhail.
No, that's a fantastic solution. I think there's a word for it, which is death tech.
Yes, there is.
Starting to appear, it's growing in the US as well. So I think you're in the right spot. So, you know, I'd be watching your progress and your success in the coming years. So from death tech to moving to climate with Robin. Robin, can you tell us a bit more about Snug and really how it's changing the way we deal with finances?
Yeah, sure, Michael. So Snug is aiming to make energy efficient homes simple and affordable for everyone, which is a pretty huge task. The cost of, we won't hit net zero unless we sort out Britain's leaky homes. And the cost of doing that is enormous. I mean, it's the kind of lowest estimate is it's going to cost £250 billion just for the UK. And on an individual basis, that cost is in the sort of tens of thousands of pounds per homeowner. So the kind of change which is needed is enormous. I mean, it's similar to kind of a new industrial revolution in terms of the amount of investment and innovation which needs to happen. And just like the last industrial revolution, which basically was one of the key drivers that created today's banking sector, this industrial revolution could drive a similar amount of change in financial services. And we're just doing our small bit, but basically trying to create that link between individual homeowners and who look at the costs, you know, significant costs of making these changes, and trying to deal with the, you know, having to finance this, when at the same time they're actually trying to ultimately save costs of their fuel bills. So trying to innovate around things like heat as a service products, etc., that can kind of give them savings from day one. And on the supply side, help the financial sector mobilize its enormous financial assets to help this transition through innovation and things like carbon credits, securitization of green mortgages, etc., to enable this. I mean, everyone keeps saying that, you know, the finances are there. It's just a question of creating the pipeline to actually make this happen in practice. So Snug's trying to play our little role just in that link between individual homeowners and the financial sector.
And it's really easy to use. I've actually used it myself a few times, so I can vouch for as slick the proposition and the product is. So thank you for that.
That's great to hear. It was always worrying when people say they've used the tool, to be honest. Not sure which way it's going to
go. No. only good things. That's only great. Good things. fabulous. And I've not used BiscuitTin yet, but I will. That's very important that everyone does that. If I can speak to the entrepreneur here, and maybe starting with you, Robin, as you went last time, but what were the reasons that led you to start your company? Obviously, you worked for large financial institutions and you've got a lot of experience in the FS sector. What led you to think, okay, I'm going to build a solution to solve the world's problem around climate?
Yeah, I guess two things, really. I mean, the first is, frankly, I've worked for a series of pretty controversial industries in my career. And it's, you know, I've got two daughters who've been consistently supportive of me, but it's really nice to be able to tell them I'm actually trying to do something that's actually genuinely trying to do some net good for the planet. So getting a bit more kudos in my family is good. But also my sort of directly relevant background, I was employee number two of the team that set up Aviva Digital in Shoreditch a few years ago. And we did lots of stuff in terms of kind of digital engineering, UX design, marketing, et cetera, but particularly in data science. And we were able to use data science to dramatically simplify the kind of journey to buy insurance. And that, you know, those techniques and that data skill is something that I'm trying to apply in home decarbonization. Again, just trying to take friction out of a journey which is really a bit broken at the moment. So yeah, so I think it's something that motivates me to sort of to try and help save the planet. But also I think it helps me use skills which I've got and for something that's relevant to this challenge.
Fabulous. And Ren, what's your journey towards entrepreneurship as well? Why did you start Lightning Rich?
I started during COVID, but it was slightly unexpected. I had started as a management consultant, spent a few years and got a bit tired of helping big companies get larger. So post-consulting, I went more into the fintech and social impact space, where I was working in emerging markets, helping people get access to insurance and other types of financial safety nets in previous roles, as well as spending a bit of time with Rails Bank in the UK, looking at how we can build financial infrastructure. I think when I had first moved to the UK, now that's about 5 years ago from Singapore, I hadn't realized the scale of the problem in the UK. So I had been very familiar with the barriers that people are facing in financial services in emerging markets and how underserved they are. But when COVID hit here and there were lots of people that lost their jobs, were worried about what was going to happen to their income, their businesses, then I realized actually in the UK itself, there are, you know, 17 and a half million people who are financially vulnerable, easily a quarter of a million of the population vulnerable or struggling to pay their bills. So having started speaking with individuals and also charities involved in the sector, I just sort of stumbled across the problem and ended up starting Lightning Reach during COVID. And I guess, as you've mentioned, Mikhail, with the cost of living crisis at the moment, unfortunately, it's not an issue that's going away. It's getting worse and more people are struggling to afford even basic necessities like food and energy bills. So the more we can do to help, the better.
Fantastic. And Sheila, you mentioned obviously your parents and your experience and that led to launching Biscuitin. Is there anything you wanted to add around that, around your journey to entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, my kind of background is digital transformation. So not techie tech. I was donkeys years ago, originally a kind of programmer. Progressed into management, big digital transformation programs, and predominantly for financial services. And, you know, my skill set was effectively as a business architect designing how businesses need to operate to leverage technology. So it was that professional experience that collided with the personal experience of closing down the lives of my parents that kind of I thought, this is broken. This needs transforming digitally. We need to be able to store our life information securely in a digital place, be able to release it, but also we need, so very simply as an architect, I kind of like thought, right, this is three components, right? Very simply, it's, we got to store the information in a format that is shareable and accessible. digitally going forward, and we've got to do that whilst we're alive. But then when we die, we have to have some form of digital death verification. At the moment, every single provider of any kind of relationship does their own death verification because there is no central accredited source of that death verification. And that duplication just causes so much trauma and administration for the people, you know, left behind. So, yeah, we've done some research in that space. It's, you know, and we're trying to push that forward, but obviously, you know, there are government departments involved in that. But yeah, we are trying to push that agenda forward as well, because that digital death verification will be the key to unlock a lot of the kind of digital thing. And then once you do that, if you've got the information, you've got the death verification digital as well, then you can actually inform all of those providers of the relationships that that deceased person had, that that person has died, it's accredited death, and they can actually remove some of their, you know, activity in their processes too. So that's the kind of aim and the overall vision in terms of the strategic aim for this, that we make this a, you know, as far as damn it as we can, you know, as much as a digital straight through process.
Fantastic. And so I can then really see it's all about impact on people's life and well-being, its impact on climate, right? Its impact on people's finances. So to the three of you, and you decide who starts, but how do you measure that impact in your business, whether it's on people, climate, society? What are your main KPIs? How do you track against them?
Mine's really short. It's carbon, and we've set ourselves, I mean, just because it's a round number, a target of saving 1 million tons of carbon a year within 5 years. So that's kind of, that's the BHAG.
And are you on track?
We're early days.
We're on. But you've had some recent good news about some large brands, so that should help.
Yeah, I mean, so we distribute largely through banks and utilities with, you know, very large customer bases. So definitely got some of the degree of confidence that it's achievable. So yeah.
But Aaron, do you want to say how you measure your impact?
Yeah, I think for us it's quite simple as well. It's about the number of people that we reach and how we change their lives. So we sort of look at the funnel of people that sign up, how they engage on the platform, and how much funding they receive. So where we're at the moment is we've got about 100,000 people registered and close to £10 million in funding that's been awarded to vulnerable individuals through our partners. So that's been quite nice to see, but obviously it's still a drop in the ocean compared to everything that could be in the future. I think beyond the data and metrics though, what we always find really motivating and rewarding is hearing the stories of individuals that have been supported. That's harder to quantify, but it just makes a big difference. I think the other day we had a veteran, Darren, who was a customer for a bank, coming through, getting help from the British Legion, but also then realizing he could get benefits, he could get help from his energy company, his bank, his wife could get a grant from a charity. And sort of when he had been in a position of having PTSD due to energy debt and was able to access a range of support that he had never known about, it made a really big difference. So I always think of people like Darren and how we can help more people like him.
That's a fantastic story. And Shana, what's your take on measuring impact?
Again, very simple. Just the amount of people we can actually get to store their information is the initial, measure, if you like. In terms of on track, maybe a bit behind. We're conscious we need to do some more things, because obviously no one wants to think about dying. You know, and it's not top of your agenda when you're dealing with, you know, real in-life situations like financial difficulty in, that Ren's dealing with, or, you know. So, it's there are things that we want to do in terms of the product roadmap to actually, you know, motivate people and try and, you know, make it more, you know, bring people in on the emotive side, maybe actually recording, you know, the journey of the life or the story of the life or whatever that then weaves through doing the practical stuff. Because obviously to store your life information, you know, to just step back and think about that, it can be quite overwhelming and, you know, too big a task for today. Every day, if that makes sense. So yeah, we've got work to do, but yeah, that's what we're on at the moment.
Fantastic. And the three of you have got interesting propositions because you all have a B2C element of it, but actually what you've done recently is going B2B2C, so working in partnership with larger enterprises. Is that the only way for a fintech company, for a startup to achieve success in your own mind? Is that the faster route to market?
I would say it's the most the only cost effective way to market. Uh-huh. You know, to actually build you know, a B2C brand and to educate the market is a phenomenal cost associated with that in terms of, you know, marketing spend. So either you have to get, you know, a lot of investment up front, or, you know, you need to be getting revenue and volume of revenue, you know, early doors, you know, so the cash doesn't run out, basically. That's my take on it anyway, Mikhail.
Yeah, I'd support that. I mean, I think I'm not sure it's quicker to go through enterprises because they're incredibly slow to contract with. I mean, I used to, obviously, I think a lot of us work for big corporates and we know how slow they can be, even if they're well-meaning. So it's not necessarily fast, but it's definitely more economic and gives you much reach at a lower cost. I think particularly on top of Sheila's points, the investment appetite for D2C businesses is just sort of almost shriveled to very little. A number I was told the other day was if you go to look for venture capital, they generally want £1 million of annual recurring revenue, if you've got kind of a B2B to C model, but that goes up to £5 million if you've got a direct consumer model. So their risk appetite has really gone away. So getting investment is pretty difficult. Just one point, I think we do have a D2C brand as well that you've clearly used, Mikhail. Yeah. And that I was actually given some advice really early on, saying that actually it's good, it's important to have a direct consumer offering at the very least to show your business clients that you've actually got something real. But also as a bit of a hedge that if you are getting slow traction with some of the enterprise clients, there is an alternative route to market if you need it.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think it really depends on the business model. For us, B2B makes sense because we couldn't justify ourselves sort of charging people who are already in financial difficulty as well. I think the sort of size of organization you work with that can really drive impact depends, because I think we do see that with large organizations, whether that's corporates or also even charities and councils, you can reach a lot more people. But we do also work with a number of smaller charities and housing associations that might not be as huge in size, but see a lot of value in the solution we deliver because it's really helping to transform the way they work. So, and they can move a little bit faster sometimes. So yeah. I think a mix of sort of medium or smaller to large does work for us as well.
And we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you finish maybe on a more controversial question. But you have amazing solutions, and it's very clear that you're in that fintech for good category. However, many would say that because those are digital solutions, it's actually creating a digital divide between those who know how to use those technologies and those who don't. How do you address concern around the exclusion of non-tech savvy people?
I can have a go at that. I mean, I think, to be honest, we kind of need people to have at least some basic technical ability to at least look at a web page, etc. Which I don't think, you know, certainly across the demographic we're looking at, for the vast majority of people in this kind of slightly misnamed able to pay segment have got at least some kind of digital capability. We're essentially trying to move an industry out of the 20th century, all focused on paper and endless phone calls and physical surveys to happen when you have to stay at home for people to visit, etc., and move that to something that's a bit less frictional. We kind of are digital at the core and kind of need people to have at least some basic digital capability. That said, we are developing a multi-channel offer, so we will have the option for people to call and have physical visits, etc., at the right time. But I think this kind of home retrofit market really needs to take a huge leap into the present.
Yeah, I think the digital divide still very much exists, and it's quite a large spectrum. I think there are reports that show about 10 million people within the UK have low digital skills and confidence. It doesn't mean they have no digital ability or access at all, but it does mean that people are on that spectrum. So I think what we do is two things. One is to try and make that journey simple and mobile friendly as possible, so that people who may not have access to laptops or struggle with complicated journeys are able to navigate Lightning Reach. And secondly, we provide access to support workers now. That's a new feature, to be able to create accounts on behalf of people that are completely digitally excluded, so they can still get access to support.
And in terms of Biscuit Tin, yeah, I mean, there's points in both Robin and Ren's position there. We do depend, our target market is digital savvy people.
Okay.
We need people to be able to, I mean, definitely mobile friendly still. We can, you know, but we need people to be comfortable about storing their information online, and some of the, you know, the older age demographic are just not there with that. So it's kind of like not our target market, but what we're aiming for is the people, the successors of those people, to encourage and support storing this information, because it's actually them that's going to benefit when those people pass away. But yes, there is a digital divide, but you know, because of the, obviously, the way of the world and the digital revolution and things, you know, that digital savviness is increasing year on year.
Hence, they need to support those people and towards digitization. So fantastic. Yeah. And I think that we are out of time. So Chris, before I let you close the episode, I'd like to thank again Ren, Robin and Sheila for answering my question today. Thank you to the three of you.
Thank you.
It was fantastic to hear about your story.
Thank you.
Back to you, Chris.
Thanks, Mikkel. And I really appreciate the three fintech founders that came on, Ren, Robin and Sheila, to talk about their stories, as well as some of the macro trends such as digital transformation and digital security, etc. That's it for today's episode. We look forward to catching up with you very, very shortly. And thank you again, Mikkel Paris, who has taken the time out to do this very special episode in collaboration with Fintech Australia, Fintech Scotland and the Fintech Cluster Management Organisation. This podcast is proudly supported by Scottish Development International, Scotland's trade and investment agency, helping businesses from around the world do business in and with Scotland. For more information on Scotland's thriving fintech ecosystem, please see the details in the episode description.